Hit it.
Hey everyone, we just finished recording this week's Left a Boom Show episode with Amy Moore Gaylord. Amy's a partner at Akerman LLC in Chicago. We covered a number of topics, including her formative experiences as a attorney at the regional office in Peoria, Illinois, of the National Labor Relations Board, including her craziest experience there and what they do with those ballot boxes when people are not voting. We talked a lot about captive audience meeting bans, both at the state level and federal level, and some really good practical tips on communication strategy in campaigns where all these speech restrictions are kind of in the air. And then finally, we cover what movies we would be in that are based in Chicago. So enjoy this week's episode with Amy Moore Gaylord. Well, welcome, Amy. It's great to have you on the show. We just saw each other in person not too long ago at your beautiful conference room overlooking Lake Michigan. But we're really glad to have you join us here on the Left a Boom Show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for inviting me to be on here. I'm truly excited to be here today.
Yeah, this will be great. Why don't we just start off? Tell us a little bit about your role at Akerman and just kind of, you know, what are you doing now?
Sure. So I am the co-chair of the traditional labor practice at Akerman. I'm a partner in the Chicago office. I also have a role in the Chicago office. I am the Chicago partner liaison to our Women's Initiative Network. I organize programming for women in our office to get us together and talk about issues affecting women in the law and also socially, having happy hours and whatnot as well, and to be a resource to more junior female attorneys.
Oh, that's great. I don't think we talked about that. That's cool. That's great. How long have you been doing that role?
So I've held that role. I think this is, I want to say, going on my second year of doing that. I also act as we have a women's cohort program. So I act as a mentor to one of the other more junior partners in my office. It's something I really enjoy. I really enjoy working with more junior attorneys and helping them, you know, as I've been helped along the way and providing support and resources, you know, helping them establish their careers. So I've been doing that, I think, about 2 years, but I've been a mentor for longer than that. I was always active in the mentoring space because I do, you know, I think mentors are really important to helping junior attorneys get to where they want to go in their careers.
Yeah. Great. Which leads us to our next question. We always ask our guests based on what I call the hero assumption, but, you know, people, leaders in our lives that were really important to us early on to kind of get us to where we are now. A lot of times there's people that are, you know, influences that believed in us and kind of saw, you know, maybe years ahead of time, like where we were going. They saw our potential maybe in times that we didn't believe in ourselves. And I'm curious, is there anybody stand out in your life that was like that?
Yes, actually. And I took my glasses off. I was getting a lot of glare and I didn't want all of our watchers to see that. Mm-hmm. So I worked for the board, and we're going to talk about it that at some point in time. But then I worked for two different law firms, and I had an experience where I was just kind of thrown in to the deep end at both of those firms. And then I moved out of my second firm, which was a big law firm, not the firm I'm at now. And I moved to a smaller labor and employment boutique firm where I met an attorney by the name of Mike Richardson. And he, you know, just really invested a lot of time with me. Helped me really shape my practice as a labor lawyer and hone my negotiating skills. He made deals with clients to bring me along, you know, billing me out at various different ways, but really, you know, took the time to mentor me, to work with me, to introduce me to all of his clients, to learn how to get clients, how to become a valuable resource to clients and to have them to trust you and rely on you. But really, he was the first one who saw a lot of promise in me, banked on that, again, spent a lot of time mentoring me, working with me, and just became, in addition to being a mentor, a really good friend. He's since retired now, but both him and his wife are, I consider, true friends, and both just lovely, lovely people. And I'm so happy to have worked with him for many, many years.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I kind of had similar, you know, similar experience at the first, you know, boutique law firm that I practiced at, where, you know, get thrown into things, maybe, you know, maybe that I shouldn't have, but give, yeah, like, to give you like a lot of, I mean, that practical experience and kind of figuring things out and having someone who believes that you've got what it takes to do it, you know, eventually you get to the point where you're like, okay, I see what they're seeing. Like, I think I can do it. Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
And just one quick kind of go back to the sort of mentoring, you know, young, you know, women lawyers, because like, especially in labor law, you know, you still go to the, you know, the ABA meetings and there's still a lot of, you know, a lot of guys do labor law. I'm curious, like what are maybe some key like tips or things that you know, you share with young women that you're mentoring?
So that's a great question, Phil. So I am one of the past co-chairs of the management co-chair of the Developing Labor Law Committee under the Labor Employment Section of the ABA. I've been attending their midwinter meeting since 2001. When I attended that first 2001 meeting, there were 8 women there. Mm-hmm. Just 8 out of the, I don't know how many people were at the meeting. We have grown that number to, we're hitting maybe 30% of the people who are attending now are women. And I think that as a direct result of people like me and some of my colleagues reaching out to younger female attorneys and encouraging them and inviting them to come along and making them really feel welcome once they're there. Mm-hmm. Because it's one thing to just say to a younger female, or I'm sorry, a more junior female attorney, hey, come to this meeting. But if they don't feel welcome and they don't feel supported at that meeting, they're not going to come back. It just isn't going to work that way. You really hit the nail on the head. There's just not a lot of women practice in this particular space. Mm-hmm. It is a highly male dominated space. But the flip side of that is that I've grown an incredible network of female labor attorneys, traditional labor attorneys. Mm-hmm. We have a group text that we have constantly called the Lady Labor Lawyers. And you know, you can, you know, just shoot out a text. You see an issue that maybe you're not sure what the answer is, or you need a sample of something or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And you'll have 20 or so labor lawyers there as your support network who can help you. We act as referral sources for each other. We act as, you know, is this a good arbitrator, or who should I pick from this arbitration panel? Mm. And then get together socially when we have meetings. So coming up in November is the ABA section conference, the L&E section conference, which is one of the largest L&E conferences in the country. Are already planning to meet up, whether it's to have drinks or have dinner and get together and share, you know, war stories and anecdotes and the things that we've seen over the years, over the past year. Because as you know, labor law continues to change and evolve, and we're seeing new things almost mm-hmm. every day. So yeah, one of the things that we've really developed on in that committee, and I think the PMP committee, the Practice and Procedure Committee, have also focused on this, is really, really reaching out to more junior labor attorneys, female labor attorneys, and getting them to come to these meetings, to grow in the ranks, to become leaders in the committee and in the section. And I think it's a great way to really get involved and stay in the know on labor topics.
Yeah. I've noticed that at the meetings as well. And I know they have, you know, and it's not just women, right? It's a diversity breakfast that they hold. And there's a lot of effort that's being made to, you know, diversify the management side labor bar, which I think is really important. And I think that's great that you're so involved in that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think those are all strong initiatives of the ABA and the section in particular.
Yeah. So I know part of your experience, you know, when you first came up, so before you were on the management side, you worked at the board. So tell us a little bit about, you know, what is it like for, you know, first, just kind of like, where did you work and, you know, what was that like day to day?
Sure. So I worked in Peoria. It was at the time Region 33. It's now a sub-region of, I believe, Region 25 in Indianapolis. I worked under Glenn Zipp, who is a pretty legendary labor guru, longtime arbitrator after he retired from the board, and unfortunately passed away earlier this year.
So I know part of your prior experience was working at the NLRB, one of the regions, and I think our listeners and viewers would really enjoy learning a little bit about what that's like. So tell us a little bit about working at the at the board.
Sure. I loved working at the board. I worked at Region 33, which at the time was its own region. That's Peoria. There was a little company there that you might have heard of called Caterpillar. So they had their own region there. It's now currently a sub-region, I believe. It's still of Region 25, I believe, Indianapolis. I worked under Glenn Zipp, a longtime labor guru, who unfortunately passed away earlier this year, but great person to work for. I had wanted to work for the labor board. This is going to sound a little bit crazy, but my undergraduate degree is in industrial and labor relations from Cornell. And so my sophomore year, the sophomore first semester, you're required to take labor law. And I took that class. I did not go to law school thinking I'm going to be a labor lawyer, but I sat down, I was in the labor law class, and I started reading the book, the textbook. And all I said to myself was, I want to work for the NLRB. I know that sounds crazy for a 19-year-old to say, I want to work for the National Labor Relations Board, particularly at the time when I went to college and people thought labor unions were going the way of the dinosaur. Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to do. And I was focused on getting a job at the labor board when I graduated from law school. And that's, of course, that's what happened. I really enjoyed my time there. As one of the more junior attorneys or board agents, I was tasked with doing a lot of elections. I was only there for a little over a year, and I conducted over 30 elections during the time I was there.
That was a busy region.
It was a very busy region, and we had a lot of people focused on doing work for that one company, and so the rest of us kind of picked up all the other work, which was great.
Yeah, you were in the aftermath of that big strike, where I forget, but I did some work in that region, like when I was practicing, and all they did was complain about the large employer that you're talking about. Cause I mean, there must've been 1,000 unfair labor practice charges, like, on both sides. It was nuts.
Yeah. And they were actually, they couldn't even handle them all out of the Peoria region. And I don't want to tell you too much about how the sausage is made, but they had they pre-addressed envelopes, because at the time, we didn't use email and faxes and everything. So we'd pre-addressed envelopes to the law firm that they used so that we could just send things out. And then we farmed a lot of those charges were farmed out to other regions too. But the flip side of that is that I got to do a lot of union elections, which was a great experience, going anything from like a little tiny, five person mom and pop shop to, huge transportation companies and things like that. I did one election for a really large hospital. It was over 1,000 voters in the bargaining unit. So, wow. Just very diverse experiences.
Yeah, that's and that would be a way to really get like a quick, dunk into the deep end of the pool on labor law.
Exactly.
I was also one of those. Well, I was the weirdo that I knew going into law school, the only thing I wanted to do was labor law, which kind of made the rest of law school pretty boring. But anyway, I was, I kind of had chosen my adventure before I got there, but that's cool that you figured that out and decided to do this. Looking back, how important was that one class, right?
Shaped my entire career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So, any other highlight, what's like the craziest thing that happened, while you worked at the board?
Oh, great question. And I'm going to point back to that election I was just talking about, because that election was over 1,000 voters. As I said, we had 3 board agents assigned to it. It was in Springfield, Illinois, and I was living in Peoria. And I believe it was like a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We had 3 days of polling, and it was, again, in a hospital. So it was nurses and other medical technicians. So we were doing polling over every time they switched shifts, right? So, 7 a.m. in the morning, 3 p.m. in the afternoon, 11 o'clock at night. We were doing, so we're polling constantly. Mm-hmm. And the Springfield newspaper, on the front page, I believe it was, printed that the board agents take the ballot boxes with them everywhere they go, including in the bathroom and in their hotel rooms. And so all the two board agents I was assigned with, we were all worried that someone was going to break into our cars or hotel rooms to try to get the ballot boxes. And then just to add crazy to crazy was that was the week, because at the time they still mailed out your board results, whether you passed the bar or not. And so I'm in Springfield. I'm not able to travel back to Peoria because of having to pull every, you know, few hours, open the election again. And everyone I knew had gotten their bar results. And I knew mine were in my mailbox at home in Peoria. So we got done with the election on Friday night. Again, it was, you know, that polling period was about, I think it was like 7 p.m. around that time. And so then we had to count all the ballots to see who won the election. We were up on a stage, like in an auditorium, the board agents, the spotlight shining on us. It's like 100 degrees because of these spotlights. And we're up there counting these ballots. And all I can think about is, I want to get home. I want to see if I pass the bar. I want to get home. I want to see if I pass the bar. We finished counting. It takes a long time to count over 1,000 ballots.
Right.
I must have driven 150 miles an hour back to Peoria. And fortunately, obviously, I passed the bar, but it was so nerve-wracking. But that was probably the craziest experience I had there. Yeah.
Okay. So now that begs the other follow-up question. As a somewhat of a like a clean freak, do you take the ballot boxes to the bathroom with you?
You can't leave them unattended. So you either have to leave them with another board agent or you have to take them.
Hopefully you have another, if there's only one board agent, like you can't leave it unattended. Maybe at least
that's
go get it to the trunk of your car before you like have to set it down on the bathroom. But anyway, that's funny.
Nobody's not touching a board agent. So
yeah, be sure to like go to the first balloting period. all right, let's switch gears. So we're going to talk a little bit about employer free speech and captive audience bans. So you're sitting in Illinois, which is a state that's passed one of these captive audience bans. But talk a little bit about, first of all, just sort of your general view of these captive audience bans. Maybe explain a little bit. Why don't we start there? Just explain a little bit about what is a captive audience ban.
Okay, so when I started my career, for years, it was always the case that employers could hold mandatory meetings to talk about, the pros and cons of unionization, inform their employees about voting, et cetera, et cetera, up until the 24-hour period immediately preceding the election. So, you could do it up until basically the whole day before. You're allowed to have these mandatory meetings, meaning that you could discipline employees for not attending or, penalize them in some way for not attending. And very early on in my career, I worked for another firm that was very well known for its kind of scorched earth union busting techniques. They were actually very proud of it. It was in their marketing literature. Mm-hmm. And so I learned, that's some of what I learned very early on was kind of the scorched earth. We're having mandatory meetings. We're firing anybody who doesn't show up. We're going to discipline them. If they don't come to this meeting, listen to us talk. And I have to say, over time, my perspective on that changed quite a bit to the point that I don't know what message it sends to an employee when you tell them, come listen to me and trust me and vote for me, or I will discharge you. Mm-hmm. And I will fire you, or I'll discipline you. And so I, many years ago, kind of pivoted to making these meetings voluntary. You basically saying to employees, we're going to have a meeting. This is what we're going to talk about. You can either choose to attend or you can continue to work during that time period. I will say, most employees would rather take a break, mm-hmm. For 20 minutes or whatever it is to come in. And we'll get to it in a little bit, but it is a little bit vague, the Illinois law, and it's pretty expansive in its language, and it's a little bit vague as to whether you can still do, even that is considered voluntary. But again, these meetings were always, considered totally acceptable, that you were allowed to have them. And now, Illinois is put into place this ban, which we can talk about.
Yeah. So I guess just to be clear, under the federal law, the National Labor Relations Act, at this point, that has not changed. An employer still has a right to, if they want to mandate attendance at a meeting. I think you raise a really important point. Like, do you really need to mandate attendance at a meeting? And I think you're right. Like, in generally, you don't. First of all, people often they want to know what the employer's position is, and they want to hear what the employer has to say about it. If you're on the union side, you want to hear what they're saying because, like, you want to respond to it. So, like, having to mandate, it's definitely a way overblown, concern, I think, on the board side. It seems like it's a kind of a PR, position, I think, more than anything else. But it is the case that some employers, will discipline employees if they, don't show up for a meeting. And I mean, so it does exist, but I agree with you. I don't know that it's a great, great tactic, but let talk a little bit about what does the Illinois law say?
So the Illinois law says you can't, you can have voluntary meetings. You can't discipline, discharge, or retaliate against an employee for not attending. And you have to tell them the purpose of the meeting, and it bans that mandatory meeting on basis of talking about either religious views or political views. And the political views encompass talking about either the pros or cons of unionization. So you basically have to tell employees what it's about, and the meeting must be truly voluntary. And that's where the point that I'm getting to, that I believe the Illinois law to me is a little bit vague on that point. Because it does say you can't reward an employer, incentivize them to attend. And we have yet to see what that means. Mm-hmm. Does that mean, you can't give people a paid break to come attend this? I mean, basically, you're getting a 20-minute break from your workstation to come listen to this meeting. Is that an incentive or is that an award? I don't know. And it's, not clear on its face. And it hasn't been tested. As you know, Phil, these laws are, proliferating around the country, but they're getting tested through lawsuits all over the country. So it's yet to see what happens, whether they're preempted by the act. People often forget, and I'd love to remind them, that the act has a specific section, 8C, which gives employers the right to express their views on unionization. For years, we've always talked about FOE, right? Your facts, opinions, and examples. We could always talk about those things. We have the right under 8C to do that as, on the management side. And I think some of the board members and the GC, would like to think that 8C doesn't exist. And to your point, Phil, about, this is kind of much ado about nothing, right? I remember being at the section conference last year and talking about, captive audience speeches, captive audience. And me and some of my, lady labor lawyer friends are just looking at each other. What are you even talking about? Mm-hmm. We don't even use those. You make it seem like we're all out there forcing employees to do these terrible things when, we hold voluntary meetings, come listen to us. Mm-hmm. But I think, they would like it if we, and they have said as much, that employers should not be part of the process at all, should not even be involved in the unionization process at all. We should sit idly by while something happens with our employees that are, our employees. We employ them. Some of my companies that my clients are, for example, family-owned businesses. This is their life, and they should not be a part of what happens in their workplace. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. And then, just to reemphasize, the act literally says it shall not be an unfair labor practice for an employer to express its views on this subject. Not to mention the pesky First Amendment that also protects political speech.
Oh, that old thing.
Right. So hopefully these cases, these state laws have been going, they've been around for a while. And, there's been some early cases. Now, a lot of times they get punted on standing, but there hasn't been a really full throated, this is preempted by the NLRA decision yet in a, at a federal level. And we need to get that needs to get on the record somewhere, and maybe there's a circuit split, and eventually the Supreme Court can rule on this. But this kind of attack on employer speech is, it is definitely gained steam. It's any any like blue state around is, you know, it's coming soon to a state near you. And it's, you know, and employers really, you know, need to be aware of it. You have, you know, you have to decide, do you want a mandate or not? I agree with you. I don't think mandatory meetings are really, the only time I feel like a mandatory meeting is ever necessary is if like you're holding meetings and sometimes a union will be like, nobody show up to the meeting, and they'll kind of pressure people to avoid going to the meeting. And in those cases, I could see the logic of going, look, everybody has to come to this meeting. But beyond that, I don't really see why you would worry about it. If someone doesn't want to come to the meeting and doesn't want to hear what you have to say, they probably have made up their mind, and that's not who you're trying to communicate to anyway.
Absolutely agree with that. And, you know, none of this bans employers, managers, supervisors from walking around and simply talking about these issues, you know, on a day-to-day basis. You know, I morning shift meeting, or, you know, just going up to employees during, you know, at their workstation, just as a supervisor or manager would normally do. And that's, I feel, better ways of communicating with employees on even a less formal basis. But to your point, yeah, I mean, if you're in that position, obviously these are all very fact specific. But if you're in that situation where the union has essentially told employees, don't go to any employer meetings, it is a useful tool that you can have in your back pocket.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you know, the general counsel would like to also prohibit, you know, one-on-one conversations if possible, or at least mandatory one-on-one conversations. So anyway, we'll, you know, stay tuned. We'll see where that ends up. Now you do a lot of work in, you know, a bunch of different sectors. And I'm curious, so I know, you know, you've talked about, well, healthcare on the board side, but I know you've done it on the, you know, in your private practice, but like healthcare, public sector, higher ed, tell me a little bit about like how do things change when you're going from like private sector to public, or, you know, healthcare versus manufacturing? Just help us understand that a little bit.
Sure. That's a great question. I'll talk a little bit about the public versus private sector first. So obviously that National Labor Relations Act doesn't cover public sector entities. It's your state labor law, which varies from state to state. Some states don't even have, or very bare bones. Illinois has a very robust Illinois Labor Relations Act and an Illinois Education Labor Relations Act that governs, you know, K-12, community colleges, public universities. I don't do a whole lot of space. I don't do a whole lot of practice in the public education side, but I do in the kind of fire, police, public works, roads, streets and sanitation, utilities, those types of spaces. And again, that's governed by the Illinois Labor Relations Act, which is modeled on the National Labor Relations Act. So if you can't find, for example, case law, or you can't find what you're looking for in the Illinois Act, you look to the national, the NLRA to look at that. The thing I think is most interesting about working for a public sector client is it's you're answering to a bunch of different clients, essentially, right? Because the client is not just your village manager, your city administrator. It's also your board of your board members, your board of trustees, your city council. It's also the actual public, right? It's your taxpayers. Mm-hmm. So you're put in this interesting dynamic of, we don't want our taxes to go up, but we also want the best firefighters and the best police department. Yeah. So it's an interesting balancing act. And again, pointing back to what I talked about earlier today was about Mike Richardson, who mentored me. He specifically taught me how to bargain in the public sector. He did largely a public sector labor practice. So he took me to, you know, all these different negotiations, and I learned a lot about those types of negotiations. I learned another very important thing is, which if you are a municipality, don't have all of your contracts coming up at once, because we represented a particular municipality, a particular city in Illinois that had all five of their union contracts open at the same time. And I'm a very organized person. I like to keep very organized, but at some point in time, I would sit down at the table. I'm like, who are we bargaining with today? Right. But it's, you know, it's just a very, again, it's like you're answering to a lot of different clients at the same time, you know. So I find that aspect of it very interesting. I still do a lot of that work. And in Illinois, again, under the Illinois Labor Relations Act, we have interest arbitration, which we don't really have much of in the private sector. So for firefighters, police officers, anybody sworn, they don't have the right to strike. And so if they can't come to an agreement, we enter into interest arbitration, which is basically baseball style arbitration. For those of you who are familiar with baseball arbitration, it's, you know, employer makes the their last best and final, union makes their last best and final, and then the arbitrator picks one or the other on economic subjects. On non-economic subjects, they can split the baby, craft their own, but basically they write the parts of the contract that you're unable to agree on. So those are the big differences with public sector versus private sector. When I moved over to Akerman, my practice did take a turn in more deeply into the private sector, which was something I was very interested in, growing that private sector side of my practice. Mm-hmm. So I've got a lot more private sector work. Not that I didn't do a lot before, but it's focused more on the private sector, I would say, at this point in time.
Okay, cool.
And you asked about another thing, but I can't recall what it was. I talked so much.
Well, I was like healthcare versus, like manufacturing, maybe just a little bit on that.
Sure. So healthcare has always been a fairly organized, unionized sector, right? They're unionized at a much higher density than manufacturing, mm-hmm. than other sectors of other, parts of the private sector. So they're interesting clients to work with. I actually considered doing a master's in public health or hospital administration in addition to my law degree early on. My mother was a nurse. She's retired now, but she was a nurse. So I remember her working in hospitals. She eventually became a school nurse. She was in the teachers union as a school nurse. So those topics, those kind of settings really piqued my interest from very early age. So I do like to work with that sector. Manufacturing obviously is very different. It tends to be more traditional. But what we're seeing, Phil, and I know you're seeing it as well, is the rise in unionization in not traditional settings, right? Yeah. We're seeing across the country, tech companies, banks, very different types
coffee
of unionization.
Shops.
Coffee shops. I've done coffee shop work. Not for the big one we're thinking of, but I have done, smaller coffee shops. And you kind of have to throw your traditional union, anti-union or union busting, whatever you want to call it, your playbook out the window when you're dealing with this, mm-hmm. these different types of populations, because the same messaging doesn't really resonate. For example, if you're talking about a group of adjunct faculty at a university, you're not talking about people who, are working a machine. You're talking about very highly educated folks and with very strong opinions on these issues who, really mm-hmm. make themselves very knowledgeable. So you really have to have a different type of messaging, different types of conversations that you're having. And universities and colleges also, they make very interesting clients because you have kind of a diverse array of clients. It's not just, the president of the university. It might be the board.
Yeah.
The various deans, provosts, students, their parents. A lot of really super interesting issues bubble up when you're dealing in the higher ed space.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's really even true now, even in like manufacturing, like that you're dealing with an audience typically where I know in higher ed for sure, very like left leaning anyway, naturally mm-hmm. sort of pro-union, based on often no information or super low information about like what unions, how they actually work.
Right.
But like you say, everyone has access to a supercomputer in their pocket and they can find whatever, and you can definitely, find a lot about unions, but most of the stuff that you find is going to be very, it's a lot of mythology, but it's going to be very pro-union. It's going to, skim over the details of how it all actually works. And in those kinds of settings, to me, like the communication challenge is really more around, okay, well, ask yourself some questions about like, how does this actually work? Like, I understand you think it's a great idea and mm-hmm. it sounds good. So like what are the steps that you go through to like get from here to this agreement that you think is going to like change everything to make it, it's the rainbow that leads to the pot of gold. What are all the steps that get there? Because that like, smart people once they start kind of wrapping their heads around, and how long is that going to take? And are you actually going to be at the table, or who's going to be there, and how, and are they any good at this? Like those are the questions that you really need to get people to start asking. Cause once they do, they go, maybe this isn't everything that it's been told to me it is.
Yeah, that's a really great point, Bill. I mentioned some coffee shops. So I represented a string of small coffee shops who were organized earlier this year. And, you know, we used a lot of the messaging that we normally do, things like the union, what they're really after is your dues. They're going to focus on dues checkoff and, you know, union security clause. And on average, it takes over 400 days to get to a first contract, over a year. I can't remember exactly what the number is, but it's in the 400s. I know that.
460 something. But anyway,
it's not 2 weeks, which is what they're being told by the union, or a month, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so we use this messaging, and it's as if they just don't believe us. And then we sat down for the first time with the union. They brought nobody from the bargaining unit to the table to negotiations, and essentially said, in so many words, they said basically the quiet part out loud. They said, as long as you give us dues checkoff and union security, we don't care about anything else. Those exact words. Mm-hmm. And my client was practically in tears. You know, they don't even care about their employees. And, you know, my clients, they do care about their employees. And so they basically said to me, everything you said, Amy, was exactly what happened. It was exactly played out exactly as you said. So, you know, we know what the union's playbook is. We just have to keep reformulating ours to get this messaging across about what it really, really means to be in a union. What, you know, how do you get to that first contract? You know, what happens if you have a disciplinary issue? You know, how do these things all work? So, you know, we need to educate the employees. And again, going back to 8C, we need to be able to talk to employees about what these things really mean.
And I do think in some ways the, you know, this massive, you know, increase in organizing activity and in employers getting organized, I think, you know, over time, people are going to have actual experience like what you just described and go like, this is nothing like what I was told. And, and I don't like it. And I think that the people that sort of sold me on this, you know, lied to me, and I, you know, I don't want to be a part of it anymore. And unfortunately, it's really hard to get out of a union. And so there, you know, the people that brought it in will leave. And then the people that are left, you know, that come later are kind of stuck with it. But, but I do think like long-term there's going to be a lot of stories of buyer's remorse and a lot of stories of this isn't really what people say it is. So that's not probably going to be too helpful for the long-term prospects of unions, but in the immediate term, you know, everyone is drinking the Kool-Aid.
Absolutely. And we've seen it already in some of these, you know, employers who are getting, you know, unionized in various different locations where employees are already trying to file decertification petitions. Yeah. The unions are fighting them on those decertification petitions. And the board is, quote unquote, helping them fight these decertification petitions. They're dismissing them left and right. They're not processing any of them. So, you know, to your point, once you're in, it's very, very hard to get out.
Yeah.
We used to always say you can't try the union on for size, right? It still holds true.
Well, I do feel like we owe it to employees to at least let them know that even if the board like won't let you have a decertification election, you know, if enough of you can prove to your employer that you no longer want to have a union, oftentimes you can get either the union in a position where they just walk away, or the employer can at some point in time can tell the union that they no longer represent a majority of employees, that that's been proven to them. So don't just let the board tell you no. That's you know, there's other ways to go about it, but
exactly. Okay. Yeah, there's other options.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to end on we always do something fun at the end. You live in my favorite city in America is Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is where I live. My second favorite city is the city where you live, which is Chicago. And there's a lot of, so we could go a lot of different directions with Chicago stuff. We're going to, there's a lot of TV shows that are, you know, set in or, you know, shot in Chicago. And so question for you, what, you know, if you could like be in any sort of Chicago, you know, TV show, what would it be?
Well, first, let me back up and say, I don't think I told you this before. I actually went to Tulsa for the very first time this year.
Did you?
And I was very, yeah, I did. I was very impressed. It was actually by way of a trip to Fort Smith, Arkansas, which is a story from another time. But I'm obsessed with the U.S. Marshals Service and the U.S. Marshals Museum is in Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Wow. So
my husband indulged me and took me on a little jaunt to Fort Smith, Arkansas, which I highly recommend to anybody. Museum is amazing. The town is great. I also enjoy Tulsa very much.
Yeah. Tulsa's awesome. Next time you're here, be sure and let me know. But
I definitely will. But to answer the bear question, definitely The Bear. It's one of my favorite shows. I love it. I don't know that I could work in the kitchen with Carmi. I think I'd be so stressed out, but I just love The Bear. I love the way it portrays how vibrant the Chicago food scene is. Mm-hmm. I know we think of other cities as being real foodie cities, you know, New York City, San Francisco, et cetera. But Chicago is a true food city. We are not, you know, just deep dish pizza and, you know, brats and whatnot. We love our food. We really appreciate the fine dining and all the way down to the greasy spoon, to the most amazing. We have the most amazing taco joints, everything. But I would definitely pick The Bear. I love that show. I love the high pace, the energy. But again, I could never work in that kitchen.
My wife and I have not been able to start season three. We like after that Christmas episode in season two, that's literally the most intense 30 minutes of television I have ever experienced. It's an amazing show and amazing that episode is like one of the most amazing pieces of TV I've ever seen, but super intense.
And I have to say one of the most amazing things is I think they use drones in the opening shots where they show all the scenes of the city, and it almost makes the city its own character in the show. I think they're just beautiful. Those opening shots, particularly in the second season, those beautiful opening shots of just the city waking up in the, you know, in the morning and everything. I love it. So well done.
I got to go back to my youth, but I would love to be, you know, in the Blues Brothers. Like, I don't know, like which, I don't know what role I would play, but like that would be a wild ride. Fun movie to be a part of.
Absolutely.
Orange whip, three orange whips. Well, Amy, it was really great to catch up. It was great to get to, you know, see you in person, and really glad you were able to join us for the show. We really appreciate having you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I have enjoyed talking with you today, just as always.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see you soon. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.